Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. On each episode, we talk with biographers about their work. In this episode, I talk with Cynthia Carr about her book, Candy Darling, Dreamer, Icon, Superstar, published by FSG in March 2024. This interview was recorded on March 7th, 2024 via Zoom. Well, Cynthia Carr, thank you so much for coming on to Bio Podcast. Who is Candy Darling?
Candy Darling was best known as one of Andy Warhol's superstars. She was also a transgender icon early on when there weren't too many visible trans people. And she was an actor. She's most famous for the two Warhol films that she did, Flesh and Women in Revolt. But she also did a lot of theater. I wish I could have seen some of those. She apparently was very good and probably better in the theater than on film.
When did you first come across Candy Darling, and what convinced you to write this book?
I was asked to write the book by her friend, Jeremiah Newton. Now, he had been her friend, lived with her a couple different places. She never had a place to live of her own. So she divided her time between her mother's place in Massapequa Park and then Jeremiah and other people that she stayed with in Manhattan or sometimes in Brooklyn. And he called me up one day and asked me to do it. I didn't know if it was right for me, but I decided to go and talk to him. And he showed me that he had a number of her journals and letters and pictures that I'd never seen before. But what really got to me was the story he told about what I think of as the way she suffered as a trans person back in the 60s and early 70s. You know, in Manhattan, she was pretty well known in certain circles. You know, she was going to fancy parties. Warhol loved her. She had a good reputation in theater. And then she'd go home to her mother's house and her mother would say, "Don't come until after dark. Don't let anyone see you. Don't answer the door." You know, there was this shame around her back at home. I thought, wow, this is like a glimpse into what it was like to live then as a transgender person. And I thought that was a story that I could connect with and wanted to tell. So I decided I would do it. I had no idea it would take me 10 years. What I ended up with, I did find a lot of material that no one knew about her. At this point, I'm feeling happy with what I did. It was sort of an unexpected journey for me in a way.
So Jeremiah Newton invites you over. He gives you access to all of these interviews. So that's the beginning of your research. I'm sure when you're listening to some of these interviews, you know, people are grappling with gender. People are grappling with the shame of Candy's existence, in a sense. I'm sure that brought up a lot of questions that led you to different archives and so on. What were some of the questions that you had after listening to these interviews?
Jeremiah did these interviews back in the 70s. He had no training. He certainly was not a journalist, really an author, published author. And I'm really happy he did the interviews, but I think I would have additional questions with every single one. You know, like, in fact, he did a couple of interviews with Candy's friend Tinkerbell that I couldn't find any use for because basically they were just talking and gossiping about people they knew. And I have some sense that Candy and Tinkerbell actually met when Candy was really young and hadn't really even started dressing as a woman full time. And I thought, Jeremiah, ask about that. And of course he didn't. So, and I would have loved to know about that because I think they met at some clubs in the village and that would have been great to have another look at what Candy was doing at that time of her life. And it just wasn't there. His interview with Jackie Curtis was very short. And, you know, Jackie was an important friend to Candy, even though they had their ups and downs and would stop speaking at certain points. But he wrote the first play that Candy was ever in. And I just thought, ask more. It was a very short interview. So really it was different with every single person, but I really wished I could have talked to those people. Jeremiah had some interviews with Candy's mother, and I would have loved to speak more with her, but at least I got something. I mean, I am thankful that I got as much as I did. He interviewed something like 45 people, and there really were additional questions I had with every single one. As I transcribed them, I would be saying this to myself, ask about that. And he doesn't. I do feel that I could not have really done this book without those interviews. I mean, he got this crucial interview with a friend of Candy's named Jackie Collins, not the actress, of course, but this friend that Candy had in the last years of her life, who was just crucial through Candy's illness and managed to make sure she got buried at Frankie Campbell's. And I would have loved to talk to her. I could not find her. I don't even know if she's still alive. For all I know, she went back to South Africa. I tried everything to find her. You know, at least I have what Jeremiah got from her, and that was really helpful.
But why did Jeremiah collect these interviews? What was his goal?
Well, he wanted to write a biography himself, and he actually did write a couple of chapters, and I have them. There was one chapter about his first time at the factory. Candy took him to the factory. So that was a chapter he wrote. And then another one was about the Tennessee Williams play that she was in, The Small Craft Warnings. And he was writing about more about the development of it. And I don't even have a complete chapter. It's like pages here and there. But he managed to interview one of the people, one of the actors. He talked to some of, I think, the producers, but it was mostly about all the out-of-town stuff that I felt like it's just not relevant to what I'm doing. Writing a biography is not easy, and for some reason he just stopped. But he had all those cassette tapes, and he really was devoted to Candy's memory. He really wanted something to be done. He had worked on this documentary called Beautiful Darling, that's of, I think it's even on YouTube. And that's really focused on his friendship with Candy. It has other things about her life, but I can tell you, as a person who spent 10 years researching her life, there's a lot that isn't in that documentary. It's something, and you see what their relationship was like. You know, it's worth a look if you're a Candy fan, for sure.
You talk about Candy's living situation as being precarious, even after she made it with Warhol and sort of was a star. How did she find lodging in New York?
You know, Candy was very friendly. And I know when the first time she met Jeremiah, and he was still a teenager. I think he was maybe, what was he, 18 or something, 17, 18. The next time she saw him on the street, she actually asked him, could I stay with you? So this is how she found places to stay. I mean, she was just friendly. Well, can I stay there? She was always sort of on the lookout for people who might give her a place. And that's how she did it. And she, when she lived with him, he didn't even have a bed. He had like a mat on the living room floor. She could deal with that, and she was happy to have a place where she could sleep. She lived with him a couple other places, one place in Brooklyn and one place uptown, where, you know, they always slept in the same bed, but were friends. Jeremiah told me he never saw her naked. You know, she was always very modest as a rule, and she needed places. So I know there was one story that I think is in the book where she's on the street, and it's the day that she met, I think she met Paul Ambrose, and they're trying to figure out where can we stay, you know, and then they find someone who says, I have a key to someone's house in the village. And so they go and they sleep there during the day, and then they're up all night. This was a constant search for a place to sleep. For a while, she lived with a man named Sam Green, and he gave her a room in his place. She was there for, I don't think it was even a year, as it turned out, but that was like the most stable place she ever had. And then with the Jeremiah's last apartment, she had become sick by then, and she couldn't climb the stairs. But then she had met Maxime de la Falaise, you know, and then Maxime let her stay at her house. And, you know, Candy was young. I mean, she was 29 when she died. So maybe when you're in your 20s, it's a little easier to deal with. And New York was a lot different at that time, or It sort of happened where people would kind of float around and maybe they wouldn't have an apartment, but they'd find a place to crash. People would talk about crashing in those days. But I think it's a stressful way to live and would have become more so as she got older, I believe.
I find it interesting that she worked on Wall Street for a time, passing as a woman. What consequences could she have faced if somebody found her out?
Well, she could have been arrested for wearing women's clothes. At that time, there was a law. There was an interpretation of a law. Let's put it that way. It was a really like 19th or even 18th century law that the police used to go after drag queens and arrest them for wearing. You had to wear, like, I think it was two or three items of clothing appropriate to your birth gender. So she could have been arrested for that, and I'm sure they would have fired her. She ended up quitting because she was so worried about that. And meanwhile, her friend Holly Woodlawn was working at some other office and basically just didn't give a damn. Okay, if I get found out, big deal. Arrest me. I don't care. Holly was had a very different personality than Candy. And she was just like, go with the flow. Whatever happens, happens, and I can take it. But Candy was more, worried about that. So she ended up quitting the job.
I was reading this book on the train to and from work, and I would start laughing out loud at some of these vignettes that you had, especially when they get drafted into Vietnam, for instance, Holly and Candy's drafting into Vietnam.
Yes.
I mean, it was hilarious, but Candy's teeth in particular, she had a really messed up smile, and her teeth would just like randomly fall out, and people would talk about it. And
Yeah.
then at that time, dentistry was not as advanced as it is today. So Candy had these like teeth that you sort of plug in and they would fall out from time to time. I kind of equated this loss of teeth with loss of money and always trying to find it. Can you talk to me about, this idea of constantly chasing after money with Warhol and so on?
First of all, it was easier to be in New York with no money back in the 60s and the early 70s, but still, it's true. She had 10 of her teeth removed when she was 18 years old. That didn't get addressed for quite a long time, because she didn't have money. Yeah, there was a story I put in there about how she passed this playwright that she knew on the street and said, "Could you give me $10? I haven't eaten anything but popcorn in, 3 days or 4 days, whatever it was." So he gave her some money. She just never had any way to get a regular income. I'm actually not sure what else to say about it. It's just she lived that way through her whole life. At the end there, when she was working with Jane Friedman, Jane got her a big salary to perform at Les Jardins. Then she finally had some money to live on and stayed in a hotel for a while and was able to pay for it. She was scavenging for things, for clothing. Where can I get my next meal? Where can I stay? It was just a constant problem. Like I said, it was easier to live in those days on very little money. I mean, I think could rent an apartment for maybe for less than $100 a month, but she usually didn't even have that. So, yeah, it's a fact of her life that goes through the whole book.
And yet she writes to her cousin, Kathy Anderson. She writes, "You must always be yourself no matter what the price. It is the highest form of morality."
This is the thing about Candy that I actually most admire, because even when she was a teenager and talking with her friends at the beauty school and transitioning and turning into Candy at that point, she made some statement there about how, "Accept me as I am. You have to accept me as I am. This is who I am." And she was, at that point, she's like, what, 18 or something. So I really admire that about her because she had no support for that. Then she found her milieu in downtown Manhattan, in the theater scene, off Broadway, and people like that who were totally willing to accept her. Where she lived out on Long Island, no, but that didn't, she was going to be who she was. And I just think that's great. I mean, the gay movement and the women's movement started in, what, 1969 or something. There was a very tiny trans movement. You had to know how to find it. It was sometimes organized in doctors' offices, where everybody was waiting to see the doctor, all the different trans people. But there wasn't really anything set up that was national. And trans people at that point weren't really welcome in the women's movement or the gay movement. You know, all these questions about gender were just beginning to form, and people hadn't figured it out. One of my thoughts about the trans thing is that, you know, it's sort of the ultimate example of how gender isn't binary. It shouldn't be binary. So I think to me, that's at the core of feminism. Feminism should be about rejecting the gender binary. And that's what was happening with the trans movement, but that hadn't been figured out yet, seems.
Right. And you found in the archives, Candy was not very political at all.
No.
But there was a piece of her writing inserted into this text where it talked about the two sexes. And she sort of highlighted that there's more than two sexes.
It was written in all, of all places, Mary Baker Eddy's book, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures. It was written in there in pink ink when Mary Baker Eddy makes some comment about the two sexes. And only two? I think more than two exist. I mean, she definitely had done some thinking about it, but didn't really make that public. I mean, Candy kept a lot of things to herself. I found them in the journals or in some place like that, that she was the only person who ever looked at that book. She wasn't around any other people who were interested in Mary Baker Eddy.
Where are the Candy Darling archives? What archives did you go to?
I spent 2 weeks at the Warhol Museum because Jeremiah gave a lot of things to them, and that was great. Right now, some more are at the Howell Archive, which is relatively new, set up by Jane Friedman, who was Candy's last manager, and they have some things there. But I also looked at different people at the Lincoln Center Library, you know, related to the arts, the New York Public Library. I went to the Tom Ian Archive out in Ohio State University. La Mama has an archive. So, you know, I looked at all of these things to get the bits and pieces to assemble for this account. Jeremiah had lots of things at his house that I spent many hours looking through his boxes. He was a hoarder, basically, and his apartment was filled with boxes. My first meeting with Jeremiah, there was a path from the front door to a chair. It was all these boxes. And he showed me that on that first meeting, he pulled out a drawer of a bureau and he had pictures in there and the diaries and letters, but there were more. I had to go over there and look through all those other boxes and everything was mushed together. Old tax returns, Christmas cards, maps, you know, tchotchkes. And oh, it's a page from, it's a letter that Candy wrote to her mother or, you know, whatever it was, not her mother, but it took a tremendous amount of time. And I had to get a friend to come with me to lift the boxes. They were huge and I couldn't get access to the ones underneath. And then Jeremiah told me from day one that there was this Mary Baker Eddy book and I could not find it. He said, it's on the shelf. And I, you know, I had that meant moving all the boxes away from the bookshelves. And I didn't find it until some people intervened when Jeremiah went into the hospital at some point and decided to clean the apartment. And they took everything out. One of those people found that Mary Baker Eddy book in the storage space they took it to in New Jersey. And she told me, I almost threw it away, but then I saw that there were underlines and things written in the margins. I said, oh my God, you know. And then another really crucial diary, someone came over to take apart one of his bookshelves and redo it. And in the back, behind all the books, they found this little diary, that 5-year diary that Candy had kept as a teenager. In other words, during her beginnings of her transition. And Jeremiah didn't even remember that he had it. And that's now at the Howell Archive. That was invaluable. Finding the material, I guess that's why it took me 10 years to do this. It was really not easy to find all these items. There were two pictures that are now in my book, in the photo insert, that were important to me. One of them shows Candy as maybe, I don't know, 12 or 13 years old, dark hair, you know, a boy. I'm wearing a boy's suit in the Massapequa Park living room. And then another one of Candy, maybe 4 years later, in a dress with a bouffant blonde, looking much happier. I found one of those underneath a piece of furniture in the crud. And the other one was in a book by Warhol that Jeremiah loaned me. And there was the Candy picture in the book. I can't be sure to this day that I found absolutely everything, I'll put it that way. But I did do a thorough search of what I could. So I think those pictures are disappeared now because they ended up, his apartment was in such a mess when the people came in to do the cleaning that a lot of stuff ended up in a dumpster. And these were all things I had copied and brought back. And then they'd get redistributed among the boxes somehow. I made a box for candy stuff, but I would come back and find, did I already look at this? I mean, it was like, it was really, really complicated. And I, at this point, a lot of it is gone. You know, it just didn't survive the squalor. In fact, Jeremiah died last November, and people went over to search for the things and found, I think, I've seen them. They're at the Howell Archive now. They showed them to me. I think there's like half of those cassette tapes they were able to find because he made me bring them back. I had them here for years. He made me bring them back, and I was worried about that from day one. And sure enough, he wanted to use the bin that they had been in for other things. The tapes got distributed around God knows where, and half of them now are gone. It's really kind of tragic.
Well, it
And
sounds like he called the right person for the job. You did right by her.
I hope so. I hope so. And
Yeah.
it's true. I don't know. Maybe there are other people who could have gone through all of these struggles about finding the material, but I don't know. It was a big challenge.
So it took you 10 years to do this. How did you get funding?
I had an advance to begin with, but that didn't last that long. And then I did get the fellowship at the Leon Levy Center. That was a huge help. And then I just started taking Social Security. I was living on Social Security for a number of years now, and I have a rent stabilized apartment, and I'm in the rent freeze program and all that. So I made it through. And also, I did have particular friends who gave me some financial gifts over the years that would help me, personal friends of mine.
I love your friends.
Well, me too. It
Yeah.
was, you know, very, very helpful.
How did you work as a cultural writer for the downtown art scene in New York City from 1984 to 2003 help your storytelling?
One thing I did during those years, I was covering mostly performance art and then other, you know, really experimental artists. I can say I always was interested in artists who were kind of working against the grain or against stereotypes and people who were marginalized or uncodified. And that's what I enjoyed working on. And that certainly is also true of Candy. And all, I think, you know, also my last book, which was a biography of David Wojnarowicz, these are people who are probably not going to ever get a second biography. And that's why it's crucially important to me to make sure that things are accurate because this is their one chance. I don't know that that's true of David, but he's had some other books written about him lately. But with Candy, given the loss of so much material, I think this is it. As for storytelling, I always wanted to talk to the artists if I could. In some cases, I mean, I was covering performances in the clubs that would happen once and was trying to, you know, try to approach it as what is this person trying to do? And in a way, not being a traditional kind of critic. But I always enjoyed talking to artists. So I think it prepared me to do the kind of work I've done since then.
What do you hope the telling of Candy's story will do for today's trans community?
You know, I dedicated the book to the trans community, and I have this hope that the transgender people are, they're such a minority and they are now scapegoats. And I feel like people on the far right are very good at choosing scapegoats. And, you know, back when they were attacking performance artists, to me, it was very similar because most people have never seen a performance artist. And in the same way, most people don't know anybody who's trans because it is a minority. You know, you can tell scary stories about them. You can lie about them. And I hope that by reading about Candy, if she'd been able to vote, she probably would have voted Republican. I mean, she was, in her way, she was a conservative person. She used to have arguments with Jeremiah about Vietnam. She didn't think we should be out of Vietnam. Just to see the humanity of one person, which I think a lot of people don't see that. They don't see the humanity of one person. And, you know, maybe it could help. You know, I mean, I have that hope. It'll get that kind of attention. Who was this person? She was not dangerous in any way. And why would you try to make a law against her? I mean, the attacks on the trans community have been so alarming to me, so horrific and disgusting that I have this hope that it'll make a difference. And when I started the book, the transgender people had not yet become scapegoats. You know, it's taken a few years. I mean, I think, when did it start? Maybe in 2016 or something like that, that, oh, we have to protect children from, like all that nonsense. I don't know. I just have this hope that reading the reality of one person's life can make a difference.
Well, it's a beautifully written book, and I think your goal will be achieved. So thank you
Well,
so much.
thank you.
That was my conversation with Cynthia Carr about her book, Candy Darling, Dreamer, Icon, Superstar. It was published by FSG in March 2024. This interview was recorded via Zoom on March 7th, 2024. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Jenny Skoog in New York City. Alani Hodge created our theme music. And until next time, thanks so much for listening. Have a great week.